Hello and welcome to another episode of the Armchair Strategist podcast. This is the fourth and final episode of a series on Indochina relations. In previous episodes, we discussed the years of the 1950s, the 1962 war, the 1967 border incident, and how these events led into the modernization of the Indian Army for 1965 and 71. In our new episode, we discuss the quiet years of the 70s to the early 2000s, leading up to the present day tensions.
The rest of the 70s appear to have been fairly quiet, rest of the 70s, right until the mid 80s, right? There was a good, 25 years period of relative quiet on the Indo-Chinese front. Is that accurate?
Fairly. There were a few incidents, sporadic incidents. I kill a few of your men, you kill a few of mine, but nothing significant or serious, partly because both sides reached a very shaky, unwritten agreement not to use firearms in that area. And if you're carrying a gun, the barrel should point downwards so as to not create a misunderstanding. And they also agreed that the line of actual control.
When was this agreement to not carry firearms actually, when did it come into?
So, officially, the first official agreement, yes, was in 1996 as part of a confidence building measure, but unofficially from much before that. In fact, by one account, no round has been fired on the Ladakh border between China and India since 1962. It basically ended after Rizangla. And in other areas, so the border is a pretty long one, thousands of kilometers. So in different areas, it evolved organically due to local reasons. And frankly, from 1975 onwards, when four Indian Army troops were killed by Chinese border guards, from that point onwards, I think these are the first border casualties. So it's fair to say that there was some sort of unwritten agreement in place long before it was committed to paper.
Got it. Understood. So let's carry on. Then there was these minor skirmishes in the 70s and early 80s. And then Rajiv Gandhi visited Beijing sometime in the late 80s, right? So what was achieved during that visit?
So among other things, now in the 80s, this is a very different era from the 60s. To start with, the Deng Xiaoping era had begun. And Deng was very clear about one thing. China should spend the next 35, 40 years just developing. No wars, they just develop. This is a different phase. So this was a post-Mao Zedong phase and frankly a much more coherent and sensible one. Because Mao Zedong frankly was unbalanced. I didn't say that.
Right.
That's what the Russian ambassador thought. Mao Zedong was completely unbalanced.
Right.
Deng Xiaoping wanted to...
proto-communist dictator, kind of like... Lenin, Stalin, like Hitler, even not, although Hitler wasn't a communist, but still, like he was one of those like power seizures, right? And these men tend to be unstable, generally speaking.
Honestly, and much is made of what Stalin did in agriculture, but frankly, what Mao Zedong did in the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, and in terms of attacking tradition, local traditions, I think he went much further than any of these men.
And let's save that for a different discussion. Focus back to Deng Xiaoping era, which was basically an era of China opening up its economy. And they wanted this to last about 40 years or so, starting in the early 80s. And just want to note for the listeners that it is actually in 2020, exactly about 40 years since Deng Xiaoping started his era. And according to I'm guessing the CCP, Chinese Communist Party calendar, that era is at an end, and now they're beginning a new era. So that's just a point of note. But the Deng Xiaoping era was marked by increasing economic and social openness, Chinese traveling abroad in large numbers,
right,
to the US and to other Western countries, and settling there even, and the Chinese economy opening up for investment. And in this space, they were a little ahead of us. They were at least a good 10 or 15 years ahead of similar reforms enacted by the Indian government. But Rajiv Gandhi goes there.
Right.
What comes out of Rajiv Gandhi's meetings?
So Rajiv Gandhi went there in the backdrop of a very Rajiv Gandhi kind of incident. That was Sundarong Chu. Sundarong Chu, again, was in the same part of India, the northeastern part of India, there was a border incident where things got very aggressive. The Chinese came and the Chinese allegedly took over an enclave which India claimed, and Rajiv Gandhi, of course, was always prepared to unleash the army at the drop of a hat. But in this case, the Soviets apparently informed him that he had to take it easy. They could not bail him out in this case because, frankly, it wasn't the same situation as 71. In this backdrop, he went to China in 88, and his visit actually was productive. Like Chinese diplomats many years later were saying that it was an ice-breaking trip. After many years, he said all the right things. He tried to develop friendship between the two countries. It was the first time an Indian prime minister had gone to Beijing since 1953, that is 34 years. So at that point, it was seen as some sort of peace trip, an entente trip. But at that point of time, he needed peace with China because India was fighting in Sri Lanka. India's relations with Ziaul-Haq's Pakistan were not of the best. India's relations with America, again, were not exactly of the best. So he was trying to close the front. So next 20 years, things progressed at a pretty much sedate pace. China kept improving. India was trying to catch up, but at a considerable distance behind. And that brings us into this decade.
Right. So what happened in this decade? So this decade has seen an increasing number of Indo-Chinese clashes. What's going on?
That's right. So what's changed? Well, to start with, starting in 2013 in particular, the last year of the UPA regime, there was a decision taken to lose a traditional inferiority complex with regard to the border areas. So there was a line of thinking that we should avoid building roads in border areas and frontier areas because if the Chinese come in, they might make use of those roads. I don't think I need to spell out just how defeatist this thinking is. Indian troops had trouble reaching their areas, reaching frontier areas. The Chinese had no such trouble. They were building roads quite freely at their end.
Right.
They were not
scared.
The UK scared.
Decided to take this policy back and begin frontier road construction.
At least 30 years too late, but yes, they did. And not just frontier road construction, they began moving. See, the entire mindset has to change. It's not just about building roads. You build one road, that's great. But they began stationing larger aircraft at forward bases. So the Daulat Beg Oldie Air Base now began to see C-130J aircraft as well, large carriers. And generally, we began acting as though this is normal Indian territory, not territory where every action it might be sending a message to the Chinese. And I believe in 2015, this policy was given priority, that you have to start preparing for a possible war in the forward areas, which obviously the Chinese did not take kindly to.
Understood. And that brings us to essentially another wave of frenetic Chinese counter-infrastructure building, right?
That's right. So Chinese, now they have built excellent roads, first-rate roads, all over Tibet. They are no longer really dependent on Aksai chain, if I'm being honest. And they've in fact even extended their infrastructure into Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. They have a good deal of interoperability with the Pakistani military. And this is where things get truly frightening for India. Because you are no longer dealing with a two-front war. You might be dealing with one very fluid front. That's the whole point of interoperability.
Right, correct.
So I think it was this fear that made India finally decide to modernize our border infrastructure.
Got it. And we've been doing that quite productively for the last 10 years or so. We've been increasing road access, building access, increasing highways, building access roads, generally doing a better job than we've been doing, than we had been doing in the 60s to 80s era.
Absolutely. No comparison. No comparison.
That's good. Okay. So that brings us to this particular incident, right? So can you lay out the geopolitical landscape under which this incident has occurred? So, you know, China is at odds right now with a lot of countries. There's the coronavirus thing going on. Then we have
I think Well, I think it might be easier to start counting the countries China does not have a problem with, frankly, because they seem to be going out of their way to annoy every nation in their neighborhood.
Right, except I would say Russia and Mongolia.
Yeah, so Mongolia has been somewhat subdued ever since that whole fiasco with Dalai Lama's visit played out a few years back. But with Russia, yes, because Russia has now accepted that for the time being it is the number three power or number four power in the world, that China has superseded it. And
Probably
Putin has invested a lot.
number five, right? Probably US, China, UK, EU, and then Russia.
I would not put Russia behind the UK, behind the European Union, yes. That's if
Yeah,
you can consider the EU to be one bloc.
I'm going to assume that when push comes to shove, France, Germany, and UK will fight together.
Fair enough. So yes, in military terms, yes, you could say they are a number four or number five kind of power, but they are an extremely important one in one context. Chinese military equipment, it looks great. It may be very swanky. The minor problem is that the engines are Russian. China depends on Russia a lot for military equipment, and so does India. It is in this context that in the event of any India-China war, Russia's position assumes a lot of significance. If they just say we stay neutral and continue providing arms to both countries, that in itself is a big achievement for India. But if Russia says that you're on your own, that effectively decides, I mean, that means India is on its own, literally, because we don't have an alternate supplier that we can trust. I don't know if we can trust the American military suppliers. So while Russia might not be as powerful as China in this context, they certainly can play a very vital role in deciding any event, and I wouldn't be surprised if they are doing some mediation behind the scenes. Unless we are sure about Russia's position, we cannot go to war. That's a
Right.
lamentable state of affairs that our defense production industry is that dependent, but that's how it
Sure.
is.
And let's talk about defense production in a different episode, maybe. Let's focus back on the geopolitical landscape for China right now. So China's under a lot of fire from different countries for coronavirus handling. And currently, they've been on this spree of picking fights with various neighbors. So we've had our border incidents. They sank a Vietnamese fishing ship. They did something with the Malaysian oil rig,
They're
and
going to the Senkaku Islands to annoy Japan. Whole bunch of things.
they've irritated Japan. And I also want to point out that they've been doing some stuff on the Korean Peninsula also. So through their
Yes.
proxy, the North Koreans. So the North Koreans have been acting very, very, very angry with the South Koreans lately, and they
They
blew up
blew up
some
that
kind
building.
of, some kind of shed or
Yeah, it's an
building where
office.
negotiations used
Yes.
to occur. So they've kind of been on a rampage throughout the neighborhood with every possible neighbor. So
And
yes,
not just these, they've gone into a very bitter trade war with Australia. There's a trade war going on with America. Then
with America, right.
there's a, and with Taiwan, they've had four airspace transgressions with Taiwan in the last 10 days. And
Wow,
that's
that's
particularly
crazy.
significant because, yeah, it's four in 10 days. And that's very significant because they keep talking about how they want to reoccupy Taiwan. So the Americans have
Right.
sent three aircraft carriers to the Pacific Ocean just to sort of send China a message.
Right. So that's a
Very impressive, I must say.
disturbing set of moves by the Chinese. So what could their possible goal be with India? Is it mostly just to kind of judge how far the Indian state is prepared to go in forming an alliance with all these other different countries? Or like, did they just want to put us on a back foot and discover if we'll just back off and stay neutral in any possible conflict future?
So multiple things have coincided. In the first place, India finished building a road in eastern Ladakh quite recently, an extension to the Daulat Beg Oldie Road. Now, this is part of the border infrastructure ramp up I mentioned. And obviously, the purpose of any road building in that area, no tourist is going to go there, that is meant for military vehicles. So the Chinese have always been extremely sensitive to anything we do in eastern Ladakh. And if you're building that road, automatically we should have expected Chinese reprisals of some kind.
Right, but
in the same area.
That seems more like a kind of excuse, right? So it sounds kind of similar to those like Qing Dynasty based claims that they paid taxes these many years ago. So this kind of sounds like it's just a screening excuse for something deeper.
Yeah, so these claims are legal only in the most literal sense. They make no practical sense.
No, what I mean is that they're using this road as a kind of excuse, but the bigger game plan
yes.
is probably something wider. So what is that bigger game plan? Like, what is China's goal right now? Is it just to cow different external enemies? Is it to solidify internal opinion behind Xi Jinping? Like, what are they aiming for here?
So there are three different objectives here as I see it. The first is that actually the road is not even the legal provocation. The legal provocation appears to be our undoing of Article 370 last August. Until that point, you had clubbed all these areas into one state. So there is a legal basis that India is saying, okay, we are going to be in all these areas. After we have reached a settlement with Pakistan and China, we can reorganize them locally. When you say Ladakh is a union territory, you are effectively staking claim to the entirety of Ladakh, including areas that now lie in China, that are controlled by China. So this is, officially speaking, the provocation to China for stepping into the Galwan Valley. That you are claiming the whole of Ladakh. This is not merely an internal political move. This goes beyond that. And the impact of Article 370 being nullified on Pakistan, we've read a lot about that. It has not, the impact on China has not been studied at all. But this is their legal provocation. The second aspect is, I don't think this is intended for the domestic Chinese public, because there has been zero coverage of the Galwan Valley massacre in the Chinese media. Zero. The vast majority of Chinese people do not even know where Galwan is or what happened there. Even within the army, I'm sure information is tightly controlled. It may
but
be
I
meant...
Think, I think the Chinese strategy tends to be to not announce these things internally because they don't know exactly how it will play out. So they do the stuff with some intent of using it for domestic point scoring, but they don't actually apply it domestically. They won't, you know, write articles about it or cover it in media until it actually works in their favor.
Well, there's a lot of hyper-nationalism there, but okay, I see your point. In that case, if it is intended at his domestic critics or dissidents, as in
because
their legalists.
In this case, they don't really have much to brag about, right? They did kill 20 Indian soldiers, but by all accounts, any number of there are also about 10 to 40, depending on who you ask, Chinese dead soldiers.
There's a minor little technicality there. What are the Chinese reporting? Are they reporting the truth in its entirety, or are they saying we took the Galwan Valley after a ferocious battle where 200 Indian tanks were destroyed? Because they're talking about a country and a media where the truth serves only one purpose, what the Communist Party desires. And what they choose
don't
to print
have anything to brag about, basically. My point is that they don't have anything to brag about in this current incident.
Maybe not. But I think the true target of this incident was the international diplomatic community, the international media as well, because the way it's played out. I've been reading the New York Times, I've been reading various publications. They're all talking about brutal medieval-style battles taking place in the Himalayas. But in South Asia, it has played out very differently. Pakistan, obviously, is gloating about the fact that India appears to have come off worse. But the true targets, I think, are Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Maldives, Bhutan, where people are watching these events closely. If China can spin this as a sign that, look, this is the traditional tough guy of the area and we can make them bend. This country is not going to come to your aid tomorrow. We are your new masters. China is toppling the totem of South Asia. Unless you topple the totem, you can't take over, right? In Native American mythology.
Right.
So China is trying to show the rest of South Asia who the new tough guy is. But frankly, this is rather unimpressive. Killing 20 soldiers with clubs in one part of Ladakh and taking over a tiny area, this is hardly the greatest advertisement, but that's the one China has chosen.
Right. And it's I guess it's debatable how much effect this will have on the Nepalese, Sri Lankans, and Bangladesh, because I do think that, you know, it isn't exactly a stunning military success. You know, as you said, it's not like they took a major town or, you know, sort of, you know, kind of captured a very large amount of area. And you know, there's no public relations coup here.
There isn't. It's more about sort of making your enemy look stupid. That's the aim they are going for. I'm not saying the Chinese have planned this very well. I'm just telling you this might be what they want to achieve. But even
right.
there, it's a little tenuous. I don't deny that. You're right that this is not a great military victory. You're killing a few guys in a random bleak outpost that nobody's ever heard of.
Right. And
now,
so,
how well
so
this
there,
plays out,
there are so which again brings me back to their other goal, which may be just to kind of send out this message to the world that they are not on the back foot. They've picked fights with Taiwan, Malaysia,
True.
Indonesia, South Korea, Japan, India, right? They're just sending out this message that, you know, like, we can be everywhere, we can fight everyone, and we're definitely not on the back foot, regardless of what you may think.
So the thing you have to understand about the People's Republic of China is, they, as they see the world consists of them and countries that agree with them against the countries that do not agree with them. This is only partly has to do with communism and more to do with the insecurity of the ruling regime. So as they saw it, this crisis has made them look stupid and weak. Why have they gone to such great lengths to tell the world that Wuhan virus is a racist term? This was engineered by the CIA and brought to Wuhan by the US Army. These are ridiculous. Why have they expended so much effort in doing this? Because the truth makes them feel incapable. It makes them feel weak. The Street Fighter, a new lash is out. So China, generally right now, their mindset is that if we don't show our strength, the world will continue to see us as weak.
Right.
The first swine flu epidemic 10 years back broke out in America. I don't think Americans felt weak as a result of that. They kept their borders open. They told the world about it honestly, because America doesn't measure itself the same way. China measures itself by efficiency, and this crisis made them look inefficient.
Right, got it. They want to look like machines. This crisis is
exactly,
human.
Exactly.
They want to go back to being machines.
Back to the future.
Right. Awesome.
Yeah.
So that's great. So now we've discussed kind of the broader context for this incident, and we've said that you know, it's part of this pattern of China or Chinese allies fighting against various democratic societies across Asia, which are Chinese neighbors. So let's go back to this incident which happened, which led to the loss of 20 Indian soldiers and some unknown number of Chinese soldiers. What exactly happened in this incident?
So based on what we have been able to piece together, and it's only been a few days and we only have military accounts for it, but I'll go with what the likes of Colonel Shukla and Saurabh Jha are saying, because they've been saying this from the beginning and they've been proved right mostly. What we do know is that the Chinese agreed to disengage, whatever the word means, and at a place called Point 14, they had set up tents, which violated the withdrawal protocols. So it seems the Indian colonel, Santosh Babu, he went there with some of his troops from the 16 Bihar unit, and they burnt one of those tents down, all the tents. Now, when you do something like this, you should expect reprisals. You're again dealing with an enemy to whom face is everything. I don't know if the Indians are prepared for reprisals, but by all accounts, the Chinese attacked them with full force. You had several dozen Indians, some of whom had personal weapons, some of whom didn't. The Chinese came with clubs, rabid barbed wire. And according to these accounts we've heard, they went for the colonel first, and they took him out quite brutally. He was swiftly removed from the scene by his troops. What we've heard is that the Indian soldiers fought back with their bare hands. And this went about as well as you might expect. So then Indian troops heard about this, and reinforcements rushed in with their own weaponry, clubs and whatever they had. What you saw of that was absolutely brutal street fighting. Nothing in the USC can possibly come close to this. This is all out warfare to kill. And you had the PLA death squads that were trying to kill in cold blood, purely in cold blood. attacking troops, many Indian soldiers fled into the hillsides to escape this very one-sided attack. They weren't carrying their weapons. Chinese chased them. Some of them were thrown off hillsides into the Galwan River. Some of them fell in anyhow. And in the sub-zero, it wasn't sub-zero. People keep saying sub-zero temperatures, but I've been to Pangong So Lake in June. It's nowhere near sub-zero. You don't even need a sweater. But the river, of course, is a different matter. At that speed, maybe much colder. The fall alone might have killed them. So we know that many troops were lying around for a while before base camp got wind of events and sent a helicopter there to retrieve them. So Global Times editor Hu Shijin later claimed that 17 Indian troops had died merely because of delayed evacuation, and boasted about how India's military was not comparable to China's, it was not a modern military, and so on. Without going into the merits of his claim, what I can say is that there's something very murky about all this. In close combat fighting, there's no way the Chinese would not have taken casualties. When I say casualties, I mean deaths plus injuries. They would have had injuries. They certainly had a few deaths. But what was the point of this very vicious brawl? Was it instigated locally? Was it instigated solely as an example to the Indian Army that this is what awaits you elsewhere? Because there are definitely places where the Indians are much stronger than the Chinese. For example, Uttaranchal or Nathula. If we start an incident there, there's no question we can get the better of the Chinese. So what message are they trying to send us? Because they just want to inflame the entire country against them. The dominant sentiment in India right now is not one of humiliation exactly, it's one of anger, of rage. I honestly don't see what purpose this has served for the Chinese, but maybe again, it was meant as an advertisement for the rest of South Asia. I don't know.
It's possible that the attack was not, like the specific attack and the bloodshed was not premeditated. Let me put it this way.
That's what I'm wondering.
It's possible that the extent of casualties, both on the Indian side and the Chinese side, the fact that there were deaths was not necessarily premeditated. It's possible that this was just a kind of, untoward result of, basically these commanders logging it out.
Yes, because pushing and shoving and stone throwing have happened before, but there was an unnerving picture being circulated of how Indian troops were beaten up near Pangong So Lake not so long ago. And this picture was doing the rounds on the Chinese internet. It was immediately downplayed on our side that this is a fake or this is an old picture or something of an unrelated incident. But the biggest problem here is the complete silence of the Indian government. Until this incident, we only knew that the Chinese have encroached on Indian territory because of Colonel Shukla. And for 2 months, the government did not deny a word Colonel Shukla said, although their allies in the media constantly poo-pooed him, denigrated him, Congress agent or whatever. But the government maintained complete silence. And Colonel Shukla is not obscure. He's a well-known defense correspondent. If he's saying something, you would think the government would, at least some spokesperson would issue a rebuttal, but nobody did. After this incident, when finally it was broken by the India Today editor Shiv Arur, then the analyst Saurav Jha, then people like Brahma Chalani began talking about it. Even then, 36 to 48 hours passed before Narendra Modi finally made a statement about it. And we saw his statement yesterday. It has caused much more anger than before. The substance of his statement was this, that nobody is on Indian territory. There has been no intrusion. Nobody has captured Indian posts.
Right. Now, that whole thing is very, very recent news. This was yesterday, right? Basically, this was from the All Party
yesterday.
Right. And it's still playing out exactly what he meant, like what the future plans are for the Indian side. I think all that is still.
So I want to just do a quick analysis of what he said, because there's been a lot of talk about this.
Right.
His exact words were what I said, but the immediate interpretation is that this is not Indian territory. The Galwan Valley is not Indian territory, and that's how Beijing obviously has interpreted it. Now,
right.
Narendra
and
Modi
is very different from what
the media.
Ministry of External Affairs said. It's also very different from what the army has been saying.
Yeah, so here's the thing. The most charitable interpretation of his statement is that he's saying there is no intrusion. It was beaten back. You play with past tense and present tense, but this is obviously sophistry. You can only make this argument if you really want to believe Narendra Modi. The more likely interpretation is that this is not our territory. Nobody is included in our territory. So the question is then, how did the 20 troops die?
So it seems like tensions are just getting hotter over the past week or so on the Ladakh front. There's also been some Chinese build-up on the Uttarakhand border, as well as Sikkim and Arunachal. So the immediate scenario seems to be that things could go in two ways. It looks like the armed forces are preparing for some kind of military conflict on the wider front. At the same time, our foreign minister, Mr. Jaishankar, is meeting with the Chinese and Russian external affairs ministers in a brief summit sometime the coming week. So can we talk about where things are headed?
True, Hotel. So, well, as I see it, the basic issue remains this. What is China's objective? And there's a very nice piece in War on the Rocks recently, which suggests that China is angry that India seems to have taken advantage of the recent preoccupation and the fact that China is not exactly the flavor of the month right now, thanks to COVID and thanks to the response to COVID. So they get the feeling that this road construction and our perceived cozying up to the United States, all this is India taking advantage of China's situation. This, of course, is a somewhat charitable interpretation, because India is not the only country they are starting fires with. But if that is the case, then obviously China is looking for some kind of quid pro quo. If you want us to withdraw from Galwan, then we want this in return. That may be what the foreign ministers are meeting about. Because quite frankly, even if they do take that stretch, it does bring them closer to the DBO road, if they do take those four fingers. But it's not such a significant military advantage that you need to bring the two countries closer to war at a moment like this. Because as you just heard, a second wave of COVID has hit Beijing, and we don't know how bad the problem is going to be. And COVID is going to cause trouble in India too, by the way. Mobilizing troops, as you pointed out in a conversation with me the other day, mobilizing troops can take months. Railway lines, train lines. Now, we're telling our troops, apparently, that you can fly in at your own expense and the military will reimburse you later. That is not a very healthy situation in which to be fighting any kind of conflict. But the Chinese have built up heavily across the Dipsang plains. That's, again, the same area we're talking about. So the question arises, what does China want and what are India's options? I don't think it needs to escalate to war. War is a big word. You can have low-intensity conflicts, like the 67 Nathula and Chola conflict. That is not a war. That is a battle at best. You can have a conflict like that.
Hang on right there. So that's a really interesting point. So you seem to suggest that some kind of phase-managed, orchestrated conflict could occur. Something like Nathula, where the two sides don't want it to escalate beyond a sharp skirmish-type scenario, which lasts about, 1 day or 1 to 3 days. So do you think there's appetite for that in both India and China? Do you think that this could possibly be something that, the two sides stage manage, where they say that let's have it out in this specific spot, in this specific sector, and let's just see how it plays out. And we'll take it from there, or, we just decide not to escalate beyond that point.
Well, those are interesting questions, and at this point, all we can do is speculate. What I think is likely is this. So first of all, a lot depends on what the local level commanders want. What Narendra Modi and Xi Jinping want only goes so far. Ultimately, the commanders on the ground, if they decide to start something, after that, it's like a rolling stone that gathers moss. Their compatriots will have no option but to join in. You saw the difference once Sagat Singh made in 1967, and he was by no means at the top of the army. So it could be some unexpected incident, because tempers right now in the Indian army are pretty high. They're extremely high. And there is a lot of desire for some kind of reprisals in Uttaranchal, maybe, where the army is stronger, or Nathula, where the Indian army is very well set up, and has strong artillery. But if at all a conflict breaks out, I do not see it lasting longer than a few days, because India does not have the political will for a longer conflict. Very frankly, we have 11 days of oil reserves. And on the Chinese side, yes, they can use this war, they can market it domestically. But I'm really not sure how much the political situation in China would permit a war right now either. It's not as though their economy is in the best shape. It's not as though their minds aren't diverted by the fight against COVID either. So we really don't know what this generation of PRC leaders and this generation of Indian leaders are like. Are they the same caliber as those of the 1970s? Are China's generals good enough to fight a war? Are India's generals good enough to fight a war? I'm frankly not very enthused by the caliber of India's current military leadership. They look like political appointees rather than competent military men.
And we all know how that played out in 1962 with Kohl,
Doctor,
and the rest. Right.
Absolutely, absolutely. And exactly. And that's the problem whenever you have political appointees as opposed to competent men of war. Because, for example, in 1971, much is made of Sam Manekshaw's supposed his courage against Indira Gandhi, which is frankly overdone. He gave her the sort of advice any general should give a prime minister, and she took that advice. We had a good working relationship. But Manekshaw's point was, we need a lot of time to prepare for war. We need a lot of time to muster up allies for war. And Indira Gandhi, again, used those 9 months quite productively. She got the Soviet Union on her side. The Soviets, not many know this, they mobilized troops on the Xinjiang border and said, if you guys intervene in that war, we are going to invade China. So you need to make preparations like that. I don't think right now India can count on any ally like this. Everything turns on Russia. If Russia turns off the spare parts tap, we can't fight anyone. We can't even fight Nepal, if I'm being honest, if they do that. It's that simple.
Right. So it sounds like we are at a distinct disadvantage right now vis-a-vis China, because China has spent presumably the last 6 months planning their moves. And this is all part of pretty well orchestrated, thought out Chinese plan, is would be my conjecture. Whereas we're in the sort of reactive mode, where we've been rushing troops to Ladakh, they're still getting acclimatized. We're not sure about internal security 100%, where the country's kind of in a bit of a disarray because of the extreme level of COVID lockdown that we've gone through. And in fact, even the military is in disarray because of the COVID lockdown, which for whatever reason extended to the military. And we're just not ready. Like, from whether it's internationalization, whether it's logistics, whether it's training, acclimatization, it doesn't sound like we're ready for the longer drawn out conflict. So I guess the stage is really set only for a short set of skirmishes, or both sides back down with some kind of third party intervention, most likely Russian.
So there's one factor in all this which I really worry about. Last year when the Pulwama attack happened, much has been made of how Pulwama and its the logical consequence of Balakot, those airstrikes. Pulwama was instrumental in delivering almost the entirety of Bihar's Lok Sabha seats for the BJP in the Lok Sabha election. Instrumental in the sense that many of the martyrs of Pulwama were from Bihar, and sentiment on the subject was particularly strong. That's what I meant by that. And in this case, the unit which is most visibly affected by this Galwan massacre, by this Galwan brawl, was 16 Bihar Regiment. The single largest number of troops out of the 20 who were killed were from Bihar. And an election is due in Bihar in November. And yesterday in his speech, Prime Minister Modi very clearly said the entire country is proud of the Bihar regiment, the people from Bihar who died. It was very easy to interpret what he meant. This was effectively a poll bugle for the Bihar election. The temptation to carry out some kind of surgical strike type operation with the Bihar elections in mind will be immense. It may succeed, it may not succeed. That will be irrelevant. It will be weaponized on WhatsApp, it will be weaponized by TV news, especially in the Hindi belt. It will be turned into a grand success. It might be, it might not be. But like I said, that will not be salient to voters. I have a feeling this will be attempted.
But hold on to that thought for a minute, because from an electioneering, purely electioneering point of view, we already have enough material. So the boys from the Bihar regiment did fight back against those Chinese troops who were attacking them and inflicted anything from 10 to 40 casualties. And by casualties, I mean killed in action. So I would argue that there is already enough material from an electioneering point of view to kind of flog to the populace.
You think so. But when I went on, so here's the thing. I'm not saying the internet is a very reliable place, very reliable barometer of Indian opinion. But it's startling how many comments in Hindi on Twitter in particular, also on Facebook and now on WhatsApp. For the first time, I'm seeing a lot of Hindi commentary that is against the Prime Minister. Because the Hindi belt is really his source of strength. And ever since his frankly unfortunate statement 2 days ago about how no Indian territory has been lost, no Indian post has been taken, which was read in pretty much a uniform manner in this country, that the Chinese are not included, that they are not sitting on finger four. So ever since that occurred, there's been a lot of very angry commentary, including in North India, which I feel may rattle a few people. I've never seen so many people writing in Hindi and mostly organic commentary against the BJP on the internet. I feel this might make a few people desperate. I really hope it does.
Understood. Correct. So your fear is that the BJP may flail out against China in some impetuous manner, you know, thereby not just walking into what is likely a Chinese trap,
right.
But also kind of in, you know, damaging India's prospects in several ways by walking into this trap, and also by kind of creating this precedent of using military affairs for electioneering, especially where it's particularly.
Well, there are many dimensions here. Like last year, even when war with Pakistan was a valid possibility, it had not reached that level for various reasons. One is supposed to be the direct intervention of Donald Trump and Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. They intervened on both sides and are said to have calmed the matter. So the point is, if we did not go to war with Pakistan last year, are we really likely to go to war with a much stronger country now, when the country is even less, when India is even less prepared for war? I have a feeling that calculation will also play a role. The second factor is this. We do not know how strong China is. So people who say that they have more men and material than India, yes, they do. But if you have a general call at the top or a general Pathania at the top, then all that men and material becomes that much worthless. So how good is China is a question that our military planners will have been debating. I don't think anyone knows the answer to that, because they have not been tested in a war for 41 years and they lost that war, the invasion of Vietnam. So yes, they might have a lot of awesome looking ships and tanks and things, but India controls the Straits of Malacca. That's where the oil comes from. Any action in war will start with us blockading the Straits of Malacca. So are we prepared for that? Because once you blockade that, it's no longer just a case of India versus China. It's an international incident. The question is, are we prepared to push all those levers? Do we have the capacity for it? The Prime Minister may decide that he'll go ahead anyway. He has a habit of taking decisions that are not necessarily taken in consultation with the entire cabinet. But, I mean, Notbandi, for example. But in this case, I have a feeling even he may hesitate. They'll probably try and choreograph a short intensity concept, which will result in a few deaths on both sides. And they might decide to let the matter end there. Logically, that is what should happen. But the real world is chaotic and unpredictable and violent. So, can't say.
Right. And that seems to have been roughly what we did with Pakistan, which is we had this, you know, like mostly aerial warfare dominated, high intensity, you know, 3 or 4 day conflict. Which kind of just it ended on a low note for India, but you know, it seems to have served the purposes of both countries from a propagandistic point of view.
In fact, I would argue that this was not even, I mean, it was at best a low intensity conflict. There was a few planes shooting up each other, and even the Pakistani planes entered Indian airspace, the ones that Wing Commander Abhinandan went chasing. even then, I don't think they exactly attacked anything. They just used the laser. They just targeted the laser pointers at the laser targets at something and flew away. It was a warning sort of mission that we can do this for you too. So that was frankly a low intensity conflict. But a low intensity conflict with Pakistan is one thing. A low intensity conflict with China would be quite another. And even though the Indian Army is not exactly short on confidence, I really am worried about the kind of people leading the army. I made this point before.
Right.
I think a really good, I mean, you might have all the Gurkhas and all the Sikhs and Jats and Tamils and Biharis in the world. Nobody is doubting their capability. But frankly, I don't see General Rawat as a wartime leader.
Right. Got it. Understood. And that brings us to the close of this episode. I think it's a very open question, what happens next. Events are rapidly unfolding around us. And let's see where things go. Hopefully it doesn't end too badly for us.
That's it for this episode of the Armchair Strategist podcast. If you like us, subscribe to the podcast and share with your friends and family members. Thank you.